Okay, thank you, Anna, and thank you to Mary and Nancy for organizing this excellent symposium. And this is the second year in a row we've had a symposium here at the meetings on insect conservation. We hope that's something that can go on and be an annual event, that we can have a this kind of symposium. If you are interested in what we're trying to do with insect conservation, there's a sign-up sheet in the back. You can sign up. There's a official ESA Insect Conservation Network. And if you signed up last year, we do have your name. We haven't quite figured out how to use the network very well yet, but we're working on it. So what I want to talk about today is the use of estimating the value, economic value of insect-provided ecological services to promote the conservation of those services. And so let me start by one of the ways that I like to think about insect ecological services is to think of them as part of the biological or green infrastructure. And most people are more comfortable thinking about physical infrastructure. And they're comfortable with the fact that we spend, well, they may not be comfortable, but they know that we spend a lot of money on physical infrastructure, things like highways. And you can see that even back in 2001, we were spending $65 billion a year to maintain highways, and that number has just continued to grow. And even as you look across other types of physical infrastructure, we've seen that those numbers continue to rise, and this group was advocating that we're really not spending enough on that physical infrastructure, and we needed to continue to increase our investment in that. So this is the physical infrastructure, but when we're talking about biological infrastructure, and specifically the services that insects provide as one part of that, there's three questions that I want to address, and those questions are: what is the economic value of those services? Do those services need to be conserved, or are they stable enough on their own? And then finally, how can we use a value that we would estimate to help promote and direct that sort of conservation? So this is from a study that Mace Vaughn and I published in 2006, and we looked at four services, not necessarily because they were the most important, but because they were ones that data was available and some sort of mechanism or protocol for estimating a value. So first, oops, don't want to do that. So first, let's look at pollination. And so pollination, this is just the value for pollination of native non-apis pollinators. Biological control, and again, this is a subset. This is only biological control of native pest species. And these are all in the US on an annual basis. And decomposition, and this is decomposition of dung from cattle, so a small subset of the decomposition that insects do. And then finally, food for wildlife, so the idea that insects are the basis in the food chain of a lot of birds and fish and mammals and reptiles. So we came up with a total just for this sort of subset of services of $57 billion a year that those services add that value to the U.S. economy. So how did we estimate those services? Because I think it's important to convince people that you have a real estimate and you're not just pulling the numbers out of the air, or else they're not really going to believe those numbers and they're not going to do anything with them. There's three basic methods of estimating the value of services. And the first is you could look at the cost of substitutes. In other words, you could say, if you didn't have that service, what is the cost of whatever else you would have to bring in? So you could say if a certain native pollinator wasn't there and you had to bring in, you had to truck in bees, apis bees, if they were still available, how much would they cost? Or you could say if you do something that knocks out a predator and you've got to then spray a pesticide, how much would that cost? And so that's a substitution cost. We didn't use that method. That is a popular method. We didn't actually use that in our paper. The two methods that we used were looking at losses averted. If you can calculate the value of the commodity in the presence and the absence of the service, then you can do a simple subtraction and get an estimate of what the service is adding to the value of your commodity. And then finally, just looking at the value attributable to that service. If there are some services that are almost irreplaceable. If there is no substitute and the commodity maybe couldn't be produced without them, then you can just look at how much of that commodity is really attributable to insects. And so I'll talk about these different methods and how we used them. So so that didn't work out very well on the PC. There are numbers there on the beetle, you just can't read them. But the numbers are less important than the concept, and that is, for dung burial, it was pretty easy to do the sort of losses averted method, because dung beetles are very susceptible to pesticides, and they're susceptible to some of the pesticides that people use on cattle to treat internal parasites. And so if the cattle get treated with these pesticides, then it comes through in the dung, and the dung beetles then die off when they try to bury the dung. And so you can have a real clean comparison of with dung beetle service and without, and you can use that to estimate the value of the service. This is sort of homage of the data and the picture here, but this is for looking at the service of biological control. And what we were able to do here is estimate losses in the absence of biological control. And this is for this is for native pests. And then we were able to estimate those losses in the sort of current level of biological control of those pests. And by subtracting, then we were able to estimate the total value. And then finally, this is for pollination. And for pollination, what we were able to do is look across a range of crops. And there's been a lot of work that's already been done on looking at the input of Apis mellifera as a pollinator and how much that's adding to the value of different commodities. And how much of the pollination of those commodities is due to honeybees. And so what we did is we said, okay, if we know the total value of a given crop, and we know how much of the pollination is due to Apis mellifera, then we can assume that the rest, none of these are wind pollinated, we can assume that the rest is due to non-Apis pollinators. And so we did that for a range of crops. And what's interesting is not actually following from our study, it sort of was happening at the same time, Klein et al. Looked across an even wider range of crops than we did and showed that the values were higher than the ones that we calculated. So as you can find more and more data, then you can see that the value of your estimate will continue to rise. And that's one of our hopes, is that now that we have this framework, is that people from their own systems can add in more data and maybe new protocols and keep making better estimates. So finally, the fourth one that we calculated was the value of insects as food for other forms of wildlife and especially vertebrates. And what we did here is the total value of those is often known in terms of fishing or in terms of what people spend to go out and do bird watching or hunting. And so we were able to use that, and then within each category, we would estimate the proportion of those organisms that depended on insects as a nutritional resource. And so a number of species of fish do. We went through the whole table and looked at which fish do. You can look at birds and see which ones depend on insects. And so we then looked at the proportion in each category that depend on insects and then added up the total value. And so using these methods and combining all these, we came up with, and there's obviously a load of detail in the paper, and I'd be glad to send you a reprint of it, but using these, we came up with that value of $57 billion per year, which I think that's a lot of money. And so that it answers the first question, is, are insect services worth conserving? And I think the answer is clearly yes, they're worth conserving. But then the next question is, so okay, even if you accept that insect services are worth conserving, do they need conserving? Maybe they're stable enough that they don't need conserving, and then we don't need to worry about it. They'll just do their thing, and we can focus on highways and railroads. I want to present a couple examples of insect service providing species that are declining, and just as examples that I think insect services in general do need conserving. And so two species that are in rapid decline right now, both natives, are Coccinella novum notata, the 9-spot, and Adelia bipunctata, the 2-spot lady beetle. Okay, so just looking at some evidence that these species are really in decline. This is for the 9-spotted lady beetle, Coccinella novum notata, and it was formerly one of the most, if not the most, common lady beetle in the U.S. Sorry, Coccinella in the U.S. And you can see that even back up until the early 80s, it was still a major player in the Coccinella world. But then starting in the 90s, the surveys that were out there essentially didn't find it at all. Okay, so here's one species that used to be important for controlling pests that's hardly around at all. It's not around in enough numbers to do any control, certainly. Similar data, somewhat harder to read, for Adelia bipunctata, the 2-spot. Again, up until, say, 20 years ago, very common. You still find it in the east. It's not nearly as common. Sorry, scratch that. You don't find it in the east at all anymore. You still find it in the west, but it's not nearly as common as it used to be. So just another example of not a peripheral species, but a major species that provides a service that's going down the tubes. Why did these two species decline? We've had other people talk about habitat changes, and we've certainly seen some major habitat shifts in the east, especially as more agriculture has moved out to the west, so going from agriculture to forest. Another possibility, and one that seems due to the timing, is interactions with invasive species, and these are species. All the Coccinella species in the U.S. that are foreign were introduced. None came over on their own. So it's possible that they're interacting with some of these species through one of those methods. And it's not just, so I study Coccinella, so of course I'm focusing on Coccinella examples, but it's not just Coccinella that are declining. And you've all heard, and I won't go into details on Apis decline. Everybody knows about the colony collapse disorder. But not only is the Apis mellifera declining, there are significant declines in bumblebees as well. So we're counting on these bumblebees and other native predators to sort of pick up the slack, but a lot of those are declining, and I'm just showing some examples here of bumblebees that are significantly declining in just the last few years. And so I think the first question is answered: are the services important and are they valuable? Yes, they are. Are they in trouble? Do they need conserving? And I would answer that yes, they do. There certainly needs to be more work on that, but it's clear that a lot of species are declining that provide services, and they do need conservation. So how can we do this conservation of these services? Clearly, the methods that we use for conserving individual rare species are not going to work for conserving services. Usually when we want to conserve a rare or endangered species, we put it on the Endangered Species Act, and it's in some small habitat, and we work by protecting that little tiny piece of habitat. For insects that provide services, if they get rare enough to be on the endangered species list, they're already not doing their job. Okay, they're too rare already to provide the service. So we need different methods for conserving services. And so what I want to focus on is how can we use this sort of economic knowledge to help promote that conservation. And so what I think we need to do is we need to lead the way. And I partly have these, not because they're the best terms, but because they all rhyme. And so let me go through these four different strategies for leading conservation of services. So the first is to legislate. And this is something that we don't do as individuals. None of us, I don't think, are legislators, but we can lobby legislators, and we could get them to pass legislation. They're an important success is the latest farm bill, and it contains this alphabet soup of programs, all of which essentially help growers to implement conservation of pollinator programs on their farms. They give them financial incentive to conserve pollinators on their farms. And so this was a big success, but at my co-author Mace Vaughn wanted me to specifically point out that we've won the battle, but not necessarily the war. The money for this program has not been appropriated yet. So even though the bill's passed, it's not funded yet. And there's still a lot of need for people and all of you to lobby your legislators so that they fully fund this program so that it can be implemented. And if you go to the Xerxes website, you can see how you can help in this in this process. So that's legislation. The next of the four things that I see as the strategies for conserving insect services is what I call educate. And in educate, I'm separating it from the others in that if we can inform mostly growers or other sort of managers that conserving services is in their own financial best interest, if we can show them the value, and that's what I meant in legislation too, if we can convince the legislators of the value, now I'm talking about trying to convince growers of the economic value, that it's in their own financial best interest, then they're going to become our partners in this conservation. And so Xerxes and a lot of other organizations are working to do that. And some of the ways that we can do that is we can provide physical shelters for things like pollinators, and we can also we could provide alternate plantings for both pollinators and predators, and then we can try to not kill the service providing insects by wisely using our pesticides, by thinking about what we're going to choose to spray using the sort of least toxic one to non-targets possible, when we choose to spray in terms of not spraying when they're out there, and even where we spray. Can we sort of spray in hot spots or things that aren't hot spots for the service providers? Okay, so this is the education component. The next is the idea of advocating, and I separate this from education in the sense that we need not just farmers or growers to do this, we need to sort of we need to be able to energize the public in general. And one of the ways that we can do that is through engaging them in citizen science projects. And I just randomly picked this one, partly because it's one of my programs, and this is the Lost Ladybug project. And it just as a coincidence, there's posters and handouts about the Lost Ladybug project in the back of the room, as it turned out. And so what a lot of these citizen science programs try to do is they're out there assessing where these different service providing species are, whether they're pollinators or in this case predators. And what's interesting, I talked about both the nine spot and the two spot, and there's another very rare coccinella called Transverso guttata that has lines on it instead of spots. And even though scientists hadn't found those in published studies for almost 20 years, since we've started this May, the Lost Ladybug Project, citizen scientists have found all three of these species out and sent us back pictures of those species so we know exactly where they are. And now we can start to get a handle on, okay, here's their new habitat. What can we do to conserve those species? So that's one way that we can advocate. How much am I running on? 2 minutes, no problem. Okay. Another way to advocate is by joining, becoming a member of an organization like Xerxes, and there's also handouts back there for Xerxes, so you can become a member and support conservation in that way. And finally, we need to do more than just put out the message, either on websites and in text. We need to actually demonstrate. I think for people to come out and see what the insect services and service providers can actually do is an important step. And then let me just end with this idea. There's a whole organization that's totally into the idea of incorporating green infrastructure in with other types of infrastructure when developments are being done in a very broad scale. And I think so far they're mostly thinking about tracts of woods or wetlands, but if we can get a seat at that table for insect services, then I think we can really move ahead in a more strategic way. And I'll end with that. Yes.
It strikes me that some of the different activities that you're just talking about are linked in certain kinds of pathways. So like the advocate legislate kind of pathway, it might be one of the key ways in which to kind of, you know, actually move some kind of agenda and then get buy-in by, say, the American public or something.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree.
If you thought more about how that might...
Yeah, and I needed to have some sort of framework, and so I divided them up. But I especially those two, I think. The idea is, are these categories linked? And I think when we're advocating and we're trying to get people to do citizen science or to be part of the organization, part of what we want them to do is then lobby their legislators to pass the right legislation. So I think they're all sort of intertwined. And certainly growers groups can be a powerful force in terms of lobbying legislators as well. So the education part plays into.
Thank you.